Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm very concerned as well because I'm white and they're black. And quite often, we white folks are depicting people in other cultures. And that's not a bad thing, it's just the way that it is. And the thing that I sort of discovered about Haiti and Haitians was that they don't see that. They don't really see the color of your skin. What they see is straight to your heart, and they see your intellect. And believe me, they have heard everything. I've even been guilty of this myself, going into the slums and saying to people, why do we, you know, someone will say, well, why do you want to photograph me? And I'll say, oh, because maybe these pictures will inform people, and maybe something will change, maybe. Believe me, every Haitian in Haiti has heard this story before, and yet nothing has changed, except maybe for the worst. And so I'm often, it's not that I feel guilty, because I don't know why, I can't even say why, but I feel such a kinship with these people. I think Haiti is such a strange place, so much a misfit in many ways in the rest of the world, that I feel at home there, because I think that's sort of how I feel. And I don't know, I found in it a real kindred spirit for myself. And I've fallen in love with Haiti. I think Haiti is a funny place. Like, she chooses you, and I like to give her a feminine aspect, because Haitian women are very strong, and I just feel that Haiti is very strong and powerful. And so I realized at some point that Haiti chooses you, and if she doesn't want you there, she's going to do everything in her power to get rid of you. She will give you such a tortured, terrifying, horrible experience until you leave. But if she wants you, and she chooses you, she really wrings the life out of you. She turns you inside out. She breaks your heart daily, on a daily basis, with her excruciating beauty and tragedy, and at the same time she can make you laugh, and she can tease you, and it's just such a remarkable, magical country. I don't want to leave you with the idea that there's not enormous suffering in Haiti, and there's many, many reasons that are not easily explained, and it's not always the fault of the Haitians, which I sometimes think is how they are depicted. But they are not victims. They're extremely resilient people, and they have survived so many things. But I just realized that at some point, if I was going to continue to work there, that I owed Haiti something more, and that I had to have her permission to continue to work there. And some really funny things happen in Haiti. Sometimes funny, sometimes, you know, it's like a tragic comedy. Like, two women, one selling a chicken to the other in the marketplace, is like a Shakespearean epic sometimes. And all of these pictures, I'm not stopping to explain what each one is, because we simply don't have the time, but I will tell you a great story that as a photographer really taught me one of the most important lessons as a photographer, and the value of photographs. Especially in a place like this, where people can never afford to go to a studio or afford a camera, afford to be photographed. But Amy Willens and I were spending a week in a little village called Duverger in the south, and so we were trying to do a little story on village life. And so I decided, I was out one day, and this lady came to me, and she asked me if I would do a portrait of her and her family, and I said, oh, it would be my great honor. So she ran home, and she brought her children in their best clothes. And I thought, well, let me make it a special occasion for her. And so I put the camera on a tripod, which I never use, and I tried to make a pretty little studio. And we took the picture, and I really worked it, baby. And then suddenly I turned around, and there was the whole village lined up behind me wanting to be photographed. So we spent the whole afternoon photographing. And then the next time, I went back to New York where I lived then, and I made prints. And the next time I went back to Haiti, I went to Duverger, and when my little car was pulling up into the main area, I saw people running in from the fields, and I got out and I started handing out these pictures. And people were laughing and screaming, and some were crying, and they were rolling on the ground. And that night, they killed a pig, which, if you know the Haitian peasant, the pig is the only thing between them and death. And it's their piggy bank. And so to kill a pig for somebody is a great honor. And we had the best time, and it was a real realization of the value of a photograph. I'm just going to go through these quickly. So I'm really trying to collaborate with the Haitian people. It doesn't mean that I don't cover news and violence, because I could show you a lot of pictures of that suffering. But I also think that we owe it to them to show the beauty, the magic, and the resilience, and the joy, and the mystery, and all of the things. I mean, there simply aren't enough words to really describe Haiti. And I've been really privileged, I think, because I realized that I have lessons to learn, and Haiti has those lessons to teach me. And that's why I continue to work there even until now and through the earthquake and a number of times this year. I'm one of those silly photographers who thinks that sometimes they can write. But I just wanted to close out with this. In Haiti, you can throw a blank page into the air and words leap right onto it. There are so many stories to tell, so many haunted spirits who cry out for ears willing to listen. Each generation has written a chapter in a never-finished book. One chapter runs into another, tied like knots on a thread that has been dipped in the blood of generations. Each generation is akin to brave predecessors, including the African slaves who bore the seeds of independence. They are all there on the thread, stained by the courage and deceit of many events. Haiti was declared the first black republic in the world, but to say it is not enough, it must be scrawled across some wall in the blood it cost. But the world forgets Haiti because Haiti hasn't participated in the world for some time. For years it was shunned because of the violence and massacre that accompanied its hard-won independence. In more recent times, it hasn't participated in the world because that might mean changes, and there are people, Haitians and others, whose interests have been served perfectly well by the status quo. So Haiti comes and goes out of mind like some mystery island written about in dark books until some news of violence there splashes across front pages. But for those who know it, Haiti remains ever etched across the mind and heart. It haunts and bewilders and refuses to let lives go on without it. No one owns Haiti. It owns you. And you become the blank page across which Haiti scrawls its beautiful and tragic epitaph.
Thank you, Michael Diamond.
Good afternoon. As this conference is supposed to be examining how the story of Haiti is told to the outside world, for my own contribution, I thought I would look at the central Haitian town of Saint-Marc and an incident that occurred there in February 2004 and the way it has been presented thus far at an international level and what it says about impunity especially. I always thought that Saint-Marc was one of the most interesting towns in Haiti, playing as it has a quite significant role in the country's history. President Dumas Saïs Estimé, who in my view is one of the most pivotal and certainly underappreciated of Haiti's leaders, received his initial schooling there in the early 20th century, and later another native son, a schoolteacher by the name of Clément Barbeau, helped found the Tonton Macoute with the political leader he supported, François Duvalier. It was near Saint-Marc in August 1987 that a car containing a group of priests, including Jean-Marie Vincent, William Smarth, Antoine Adrien, and Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was attacked at a roadblock and the priests nearly killed. In March of the following year, also near Saint-Marc, soldiers from the town's garrison, acting at the behest of local landowners, burned dozens of homes and killed at least 11 peasants who had been agitating for agrarian reform in the region. In February 2004, Haiti was in the final days of a rebellion against the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a rebellion that had begun after the murder of Amiot Metier, leader of the Cannibal Army street gang, a pro-government gang, until his body was found on the road between Saint-Marc and Gonaïves in September 2003. After several months of pitched battles between the Cannibal Army, who blamed the Haitian president for their leader's demise, and government security forces, and a swelling tide of protests, members of Haiti's disbanded military joined the revolt from their sanctuaries in the Dominican Republic. By the time the Trinidadian photojournalist Alex Males and I, along with two Haitian friends, arrived in Saint-Marc, the north of the country had fallen into rebel hands, and the town represented the last major obstacle for the rebels on the road to Port-au-Prince. We did not know it as we approached the town that day, but during the visit and on two subsequent trips I made, it became clear that during that February, Saint-Marc had turned into a killing ground. On February 7th, an armed anti-Aristide group known by the acronym RAMICOS, based in the neighborhood of La Cirée, had taken advantage of the chaos to drive government forces from the town, seizing the local police station, which they then set on fire. 2 days later, the combined forces of Haiti's National Police and the Unité de Sécurité de la Garde du Palais National, USGPN, a unit directly responsible for the president's personal security, and a local paramilitary organization named Balewuze, whose name means clean sweep in Creole, retook much of the city. As security forces and Balewuze members patrolled its streets together, Aristide's Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune, also serving as the head of the Conseil Supérieur de la Police Nationale d'Haïti, flew into the city, giving a press conference during which he stated the National Police Force alone cannot reestablish order. By February 11th, Balewuze, headed by a former parliamentary representative of Aristide's Famille Lavalas party named Aminus Mayette, had commenced the battle to retake La Cirée. Witnesses in La Cirée described to me how one of Balewuze's leading members, a government employee named Ronald Dauphin, known to residents as Black Ronald, patrolled Saint-Marc in a police uniform, even though he was in no way affiliated with the police. Though RAMICOS attempted to build a roadblock barring entrance to La Cirée, the reinforced government partisans quickly overran it. As RAMICOS members attempted to flee over the Morne Calvaire that rose imposingly behind the city, a foreign news photographer watched as government forces, with the aid of a helicopter, chased them down, shooting several in the back. Entering La Cirée, they sent the RAMICOS headquarters, located in a building housing several other businesses, ablaze. As Amazil Jean-Baptiste returned home, she found her son, Kenel Saint-Gilles, a 23-year-old carpenter with no political affiliation, groaning with a bullet in each thigh. Taking him to the home of a local pastor for aid, she watched as seven armed men, including three dressed in police uniforms, accused Saint-Gilles of being a RAMICOS militant who had shot at them. He was dragged from the house, beaten unconscious, and thrown into a burning cement depot where he died. Residents of the town tell of other crimes, the decapitation of unarmed RAMICOS member Leroy Joseph, the killing of RAMICOS second-in-command Nixon Francois, the gang rape by Balewuze of a 21-year-old woman in the ruins of the burned-out commissariat. When I visited Saint-Marc in February 2004, shortly after Balewuze's raid into La Cirée, I interviewed Haitian security forces and Balewuze members patrolling the city as a single-armed unit. A local priest told me matter-of-factly at the time of Balewuze that these people don't make arrests, they kill. During that first visit for my trouble, I had a pistol held to my head at one point by a Balewuze member as well. A member of a Human Rights Watch delegation that visited Saint-Marc a month after the killings concluded that at least 27 people had been murdered by pro-government forces between February 11th and Aristide's flight into exile at the end of the month. Following the president's overthrow, several members of Balewuze were lynched while Yvonne Neptune turned himself over to the interim government that ruled Haiti from March 2004 until May 2006, held in prison without trial until his release on humanitarian grounds. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights found that the Haitian state had violated the American Convention on Human Rights in its detention of Neptune, though stressed that it was not a criminal court in which criminal responsibility of an individual could be examined. Neptune ran unsuccessfully for president in Haiti's recent elections. After being jailed for 3 years without trial, Aminus Mayette was freed from prison in April 2007. Arrested in 2004, Ronald Dauphin subsequently escaped from jail and was rearrested during the course of an anti-kidnapping raid in Haiti's capital in July 2006. Despite several chaotic public hearings to date, none of the accused for the killings of La Cirée has ever gone to trial. As have exile leaders before him, Mr. Aristide himself continues to enjoy a gilded exile, this time in South Africa, his lifestyle and protection package bankrolled by South African taxpayers. Though the victims of the Saint-Marc killings formed an organization to advocate on their behalf, far from being supported in their calls for justice, the events they experienced have become a political football among international political actors. I've asked myself many times why the suffering of what happened to people like those in Saint-Marc and places such as Jean Rabel and Piat in the years before matters so little to Haiti's foreign friends. Why such an atrocity is so easily papered over in the name of ideology, political expediency, or intellectual laziness. I still have not come up with a satisfactory answer, save for what Saint-Marc and incidents like it say about Haiti and the international community's involvement with it over the years. During the heyday of the recently returned prodigal son, Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier, an era when prisoners in the notorious Fort Dimanche died by execution, torture, or simply wasted away amid conditions that were an affront to humanity, Ron Brown, then acting as deputy chairman of the Democratic National Committee and later serving as the Secretary of Commerce for Bill Clinton, himself now in charge of reconstructing Haiti, lobbied the U.S. Congress on behalf of the dictator, pocketing more than $500,000 for his efforts. Today, a U.S.-based organization lauds Mr. Dauphin as a Haitian grassroots activist, not coincidentally listed as one of the group's founders and serving as the chairman of its board of directors is a Miami attorney whose law firm earned millions of dollars representing the Aristide government and who continues to work as Mr. Aristide's lawyer in the United States. Impunity begets impunity. Jean Rabel begets Piat, begets Rabiteau, begets La Cire. As foreigners attempt to recount its history, Haiti deserves better than this. I think we have a responsibility to write a Haitian history that reflects the reality of those in the back of sweltering camionettes, in crowded shantytowns, and in hard-scrabble peasant fields, far away from the echo chamber of the intelligentsia in which so much of the right and the left that comment on Haiti so often seem to marinate. The Haitians, the everyday Haitians who have struggled so long against such great odds to build a decent country and to provide for their families despite so many obstacles, deserve to have their voices heard, no matter what powerful forces in the U.S., in the United States, it makes uncomfortable. We owe them at least that, I think. The Haitians have a lot more to teach us about their country than we can teach them. So, amidst all the politicking, self-promoting, score-settling, and profiteering occurring in the landscape of post-earthquake Haiti, spare a moment's thought for the people of Saint-Marc and those like them across Haiti who still wait for justice. Thank you.
We're going to move on to the next group. There are quite literally two bells in the next group. The first is Madison Smart Bell. He's the author of numerous works of prose, including three novels about the Haitian Revolution and a biography of Toussaint Louverture. He teaches at Goucher College. Axel Liotot is a designer and art collector, very actively involved in art preservation, especially in the reconstruction of the Centre d'Art and the restoration of historic buildings in Jacmel. And David Bell, the other Bell, is a documentary filmmaker and founder of Cine Institute, Haiti's film school based in Jacmel. He began working in Haiti in 1993. He is also the co-founder of Haiti's International Film Festival, Festival Film Jacmel, co-founder of Brand Aid Project, and he serves on the board of directors of Crowing Rooster Arts and Artists for Peace and Justice. Madison Smart Bell.
Uguno, wa de his ons, lim sans petit à moi, soit à moi, soit à moi, para Ugo, soit à moi, lim sans petit à moi, soit à moi. Oguno, diable a dit la mangez-moi si ça vrai. Oguno, diable a dit la mangez-moi si ça vrai. Mais gagne un bon Dieu, gagne à tous les saillots. Oguno, diable a dit la mangez-moi si ça vrai, pas foutre vrai, ça c'est jouet timonio, ça c'est blague. Oguno, wa des anges, l'aime sans petit à moi, sois là moi.
Our time is limited. One of the ways in which Haitian stories express themselves is through dream. And I'm going to read a dream that just was hastily typed up a couple of weeks ago upon waking, with really no revision except for excising a couple of names. January 6, 2011, dreamed that I had to fight a Haitian witch, don't know Creole for female Bokor, who was hatching a malevolent spiritual power, unclear what she was going to do with it. In an earlier dream the same night, I had to fight a black gem in the Peafowl house. By the way, don't worry if this doesn't make any sense. It's a dream. Because I knew if I slept, he would kill me. He would stab me through the wire if I slept outside the pen. He was as hard to kill as a possum, hard to grapple as a weasel. The Haitian witch was young, attractive, with a medium afro. I would combat her either by carrying my weapons, a shotgun, some spiritual thing, along internal lines from the big house to Mutt's or along the road. Each had different dangers and advantages. But the houses were in Haiti, of course. Ours, my wife was staying there too, was modern and luxurious. Richard Morris was the owner, it seemed. When my wife sent me to spy on the neighbor on the left, I was sweeping his walks, and when he saw me, I said, "Monsieur Richard Voyen," which he approved. I was with Monshoon. Monshoon is a mambo who died a couple of years ago, who I knew. I was fortunate enough to know at the end of her life, very powerful person. I was with Monshoon, but in a different body, in a marché where the witch was. She sold us a cup of magic pooch like cinnamon, but I didn't want Monshoon to accept it because it was less than half what the witch had, and this violated a rule and also gave the witch more power. I objected in Creole loudly, thinking that Monshoon was careless because of her age, and the witch heard me, of course, but all she did was introduce herself very friendly in English as Tony, though I knew this was not her real name. The whole dream was full of this sort of doublure in language, manner, attitude, intention. The witch had a storehouse in front of our house. All the three compounds were spiralisé in the true Haitian manner. The storehouse was like a Haitian granary on stilts, but three stories high. With two Haitian friends, I got in by climbing a tree overlooking a hole in the roof. Through the hole, I could see some sort of bird nest things, and the spirit power was perhaps in one of these, but I couldn't locate it precisely, though I could see it, feel it near. My friends were looking at a bisongo layout on the floor, and I noticed in the corner several heavy rifles hanging on pegs for defense of the witch's house, as against my hidden shotgun, which I think had some sort of magic bullet too. I was thinking it would be difficult for the witch to get to these guns quickly when we heard her return. My friends went back out the roof hole, but it seemed too small for me in the other direction. I came out the door, which locked behind me automatically, and down the ladder quickly enough that I thought the witch had not seen where I had been. She received us on a sofa beneath the storehouse. English conversation, banal. My Haitian friends had turned into my wife and Richard Morse. I had an image of a mother wanting to receive a suffering child, Haiti and the U.S., this appeared to stand for in the dream, in three cartoon panels, the middle one empty, to represent impossible, I made a typo here, I wrote down impossible difference when I know I was thinking impossible distance. I was not able to articulate this in the conversation. A dog, shaggy grand white sheepdog, came in with a heavy chrome chain I had meant to take from the storehouse. I played tug with the dog and ended up in possession of a chain, which would help me in my struggle if I could get away with it. I did not think the dog was a real dog, however. When we parted, I simply carried the chain with me. If I had such effrontery, the witch could not object. Returning to the house with my wife, I asked that the air conditioning be turned up so I could think more coldly, but then thought that this was wrong, that I would not then be thinking in the Haitian manner. Something was wrong with one of our cars so that it went diagonally. I could still control it, but was thinking that to kill a blanc by enchantment, it would be something banal like bewitching a car. I had to appear before a sort of spiritual secretary to get a new computer password. Richard, boss of this procedure, was looking on. The first Creole phrases I wanted were taken. No, no was free. And in the dream, I associated it with Tanya saying that I was no, no in Haitian matters, inside the inside. But when I woke, I thought more of the Nano Rev, Dream Double in Mimarosa's book. This is my show and tell object. Got it? And now, last little bit. I'm going to read a fragment of the scene from a short story called $20, which is about a guy called Dr. Oliver. He's not based on Paul Farmer. He's actually sort of opposite care personality to Paul Farmer, but he is an international aid worker. With a drug habit, he finds himself trapped in Cap-Haïtien because of a soulèvement, political events, and he runs out of prescription pharmaceutical heroin that he needs, and so he tries to buy some from an acquaintance of his called Magloire, who, like many Haitians, needs money by any means necessary. And this little scene is between him and a character called Charlie Chapeau, who is a projection. He's a character I projected as an alter ego. I'm called by some people in OCAP, Madison Chapeau. But projecting as a character gave me a little ironic distance on the guy. He's not me, but he does express some of my thinking. When Charlie Chapeau opened the envelope and curled his index finger into it, Dr. Oliver felt a stronger stab. Somebody's messing with my dope. Charlie Chapeau rubbed a generous amount of white powder between his thumb and forefinger. I don't know, he said, and dragged his finger through a drop of water on the table. A smear like white paint appeared on the wood of the tabletop. I wouldn't run this up my nose. Charlie caught Oliver's eye. It's lime, I think. What, quicklime? No, no, they're not trying to hurt you. It's like chalk, basically. They use it for whitewash. Charlie closed the envelope and flicked it across the table like a paper football. What did you pay for it? $20. Right, said Charlie, kind of suspiciously cheap, don't you think? He looked out the ring of local light toward the fires on the barricades. I don't know, though. In 97, I could have bought an assault rifle for that in the Capitol. $20. Ever wish you had, Dr. Oliver managed to say from the depths of a chill now locked around his heart. Sometimes, yeah, Charlie said, but you know, if you've got one of those things, the odds go up, somebody will get killed with it. He turned his head back into the circle of lamplight. Don't feel so bad, you can try again tomorrow. Why not, Dr. Oliver said. Why not feel bad? What I love about this country is that magical thinking actually does work here. But it's got to have a little something to work with. Like Magloire, in better circumstances, he'd be a completely honest person. As it is, he has to cut a corner sometimes. The drums had got louder and there was chanting now, too. Charlie Chapeau turned his head into the wind that came constantly off the bay, flipped up his red bandana and knotted it tight to the nape of his neck. He's going to leave me, Dr. Oliver thought. Charlie leaned toward him across the table. Understand, Magloire wanted you to have what you wanted. His desire is for you to have what you need. And for him to have what he needs and for all this to work out, somebody has to spin straw into gold. If a charm had worked like he wanted it to, you'd come out with a coin instead of a dry leaf. As it is, thank you.
Ça c'est jouet timonio, ça c'est blague. Oguno, what is ons? L'imsons et petit à moi. Voilà moi.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.